I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 11th of February. Leaders of Russia, Ukraine, France, and Germany are in Minsk today for peace talks. The president of Ukraine has said that either the situation goes down the road of de-escalation, ceasefire, or the situation goes out of control. The president yesterday of the United States spoke with Vladimir Putin yesterday, President Obama saying to him, if Russia continues its aggressive actions in Ukraine, including by sending troop weapons and financing to support the separatists, the cost for Russia will rise. Our guest this hour is a former ambassador to Ukraine, Stephen Pfeiffer. He's director of the Brookings Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative and a senior fellow with the Center for the 21st Century Security and Intelligence and the Center on the U.S. and Europe in the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. He focuses on arms control, Russia, and Ukraine. He's a retired Foreign Service officer with more than 25 years with the State Department. And he was U.S. ambassador to Ukraine from 98 to 2000. He has served at the U.S. embassies in Warsaw, Moscow, and London, is co-author of a number of publications, including Opportunity, Next Steps in Reducing Nuclear Arms. We'll be welcoming phone calls from Ambassador Pfeiffer. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Ambassador Pfeiffer, thank you very much for being with us. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You have said that the situation right now with Ukraine and Russia is the biggest security threat that Europe has faced since the end of the Cold War. Can you talk more about that? Why do you think so?
Well, you have a major military conflict going on. Figures already say more than 5,000 dead in eastern Ukraine. My guess is those figures are perhaps substantially understated. And it's a concern about what this means regarding Russian policy, not just towards Ukraine, but in essence, from the end of the Cold War, end of World War II, really, European security order was based on a number of rules. The most important was you do not use force to change borders. You do not use force to take territory from neighboring states. And in the last year, we've seen Russia grossly violate those rules. And that is a threat to the European security order, I would argue.
And why is Russia doing this now?
Well, that's a very good question for Vladimir Putin. I think this goes back to Russian extreme discomfort with what happened back in February of last year, when after the violence of the demonstrations in Kyiv, then-President Yanukovych left Kyiv and then ultimately fled Ukraine. And the Russians became very concerned about what the government that came in behind when that government said, our number one foreign policy goal is to draw closer to the European Union. And within days, you saw the appearance of what Ukrainians called little green men. These were military people, clearly professional soldiers by their bearing, in Russian-style combat uniforms, but with no insignia. They occupied Crimea. On March 3rd of last year, Mr. Putin denied they were Russian soldiers. 2 months later, he was giving them commendations.
Please give us, fill us in again on the history of the accord that was signed by, who was it, the United States, Russia, Great Britain, that looked at, when the Ukraine voted for independence, that looked at ridding the country of nuclear weapons. What did the Russians agree to?
Right.
What did the Ukrainians agree to? What's the background?
Yeah, this was the Budapest Memorandum on Security Assurances, in which the United States, Russia, and Great Britain pledged to respect Ukraine's sovereignty, its territorial integrity, and its independence, and pledged not to use force or threaten to use force against Ukraine. And Russia has grossly violated all of those commitments. Now, it was the Budapest Memorandum on Assurances, not guarantees, because we were very clear when we negotiated the document, and I was participating in that negotiation, very clear with the Ukrainians that if there's a violation, we are not going to have American military troops come to your aid. It's not the kind of guarantee that a NATO ally has. But it certainly was intended as an assurance that the United States would take a strong interest in Ukraine. And I would argue that the violation of that agreement by the Russians is a reason why the United States should be supportive and more supportive of Ukraine than we have thus far. And we should bear in mind, I mean, the whole point of that agreement was in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed, Ukraine had on its territory the world's third largest nuclear arsenal, including 1,900 strategic nuclear warheads targeted at the United States. And part of the price they asked for to get rid of those weapons, and by 1996 they had transferred all of the warheads to Russia to be eliminated, to be dismantled. Part of the price was that Budapest Memorandum. So there was a deal we made back in 1994 that I think we now have to honor.
Have they all been dismantled by the Russians?
As far as we know, yes. The Ukrainians and the Russians, I mean, the Ukrainians were adamant that the warheads would go. Well, the Ukrainians did not have the facilities to dismantle the warheads in Ukraine. But they worked out an arrangement with Russia so that they could be assured that the warheads that went back were, in fact, dismantled and did not simply go into the Russian inventory.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea of what Putin's grand design here is? Is he just looking to take over territory that has a lot of people who speak Russian as first language and identify as being Russian? Is he trying to take over more of Ukraine? What's he doing?
Well, I think certainly the occupation of Crimea. Crimea was the one part of Ukraine where ethnic Russians constituted the majority of the population. And there's a historical connection between Russia and Crimea. But I think it became very quickly apparent that even with Crimea, he would not be happy having Crimea if the rest of Ukraine then proceeded to draw closer to the European Union. And so you then saw in April of last year, armed separatists, more little green men turn up in Donetsk and Luhansk in the far eastern part of Ukraine. And it looks to me like so far the Russian goal has been simply to create instability and chaos through funding, supporting, providing heavy weapons to the separatists, the goal being to destabilize the Ukrainian government so it cannot focus either on a long list of economic reforms it has to do, and it cannot focus on implementing the association agreement and drawing closer to the European Union. So that seems to be the objective. I worry, and we'll see, literally as we speak, there's a negotiation going on in Minsk. We'll see if an agreement comes out of that. I tend to be very modest in my expectations because I worry that the Russian objective is simply to keep Ukraine off balance. And the ugly, horrific mess that you now see in eastern Ukraine satisfies that objective.
Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of deal was reached in September that obviously was not upheld?
Yeah, basically there was a ceasefire. It was agreed with the Russian ambassador to Ukraine signing for Russia. But it was a 12-point plan for a ceasefire. It called for things like withdrawal of all heavy weapons. It called for securing the Russian-Ukraine border and giving Ukraine, again, control over its border with Russia so that it could understand what was coming into Ukraine from Russia. It called for things like elections in the occupied areas. And unfortunately, the ceasefire never really took. It reduced the amount of fighting for a period, but then it sprung up, and it appears in the last 3 or 4 weeks you've got fighting pretty much in 3 or 4 major points along the line of contact. So the ceasefire didn't hold, and the Russians did not implement any of the requirements on them. They did nothing to secure the border with Ukraine. They did not withdraw their equipment. In fact, we've heard both from Ukrainian sources but also from NATO that they've seen a significant inflow of Russian armor into eastern Ukraine over the last couple of months. In fact, I was at NATO headquarters about a month ago, and a NATO military officer said, you know, in the summer when the Russians sent tanks into the separatists, they tried to hide it. They don't even bother to try to hide it anymore. And so you saw the ceasefire never took hold, fighting continued, and today the separatists and their Russian supporters, and I do believe there are still Russian troops in eastern Ukraine, they occupy about 200 square miles territory more that they did not occupy when the ceasefire supposedly kicked in on September 5.
You've called for this recommendation, the U.S. government provide Ukraine additional military assistance, including defensive weapons. Why are you calling for that, and what should we send?
Yeah. Well, this was a group, actually 8 of us, 5 of whom traveled to NATO and traveled to Ukraine for discussions on the question. And I should start by saying the point here is none of us in the group wanted to prolong the war. And also, we don't think the Ukrainian army can beat the Russian army. But the question is, could we fill in some gaps for the Ukrainians that would allow them to defend their own territory better? And we need to remember, they're fighting the separatists and they're fighting Russian military forces on Ukrainian territory in a way that would raise the cost to the Russians so that the Russians would conclude the military option doesn't make sense. They should then pursue more seriously a negotiated diplomatic outcome. And so we had some discussions at NATO headquarters. Five of us then went to Ukraine. We had 4 days of discussions both in Kyiv at the Ministry of Defense, the Presidential Administration, the National Security Council, the head of their security service, and others. And then we actually went out and spent a day at the front headquarters in a place called Kramatorsk, which you may have seen was rocketed by the separatists and the Russians yesterday. Mm-hmm. And we came back with a fairly discreet list of equipment that the Ukrainians wanted, most of which is non-lethal. The most important thing that they asked for, they said, was a counter-battery radar. This would be a radar that would see out 30 to 40 kilometers and would pinpoint the origin of incoming rocket strikes and artillery strikes so they could fire back. And we had one Ukrainian colonel told us that he estimated about 70% of Ukrainian military casualties are from rocket and artillery strikes. And they said that was desperately needed. They can use things like unmanned aerial vehicles, drones, for intelligence gathering purposes. They can use secure communications. The one piece of lethal assistance that they asked for was light anti-armor weapons. And what we heard in Kyiv was that although they have a stockpile of their own, and these are man-portable, maybe anti-tank rockets, the stockpiles they have are at least 20 years old, and they're finding that about three-quarters of them just don't work. So that was the one we were urging a change in policy to provide that bit of anti-tank weaponry. But again, the whole goal of this is to try to change the calculation in Moscow and move Russia away from support for continued fighting in eastern Ukraine to get them to a serious effort at a negotiation.
Hmm.
And we'll see whether the threat, I think it was probably useful to Chancellor Merkel as she was talking to the Russians last week and as she's talking to the Russians now, that this discussion about perhaps providing weapons to Ukraine is playing out. It gives the United States the chance to play the tough cop to her good cop. And hopefully that has some kind of an impact, and we'll see if President Putin is prepared to negotiate in a serious way today.
Mm-hmm. But doesn't it stand to reason that the Ukrainians would still not be up to the task of taking on the incredible Russian military, and one of the best probably in the whole world? Don't they need just more than we could possibly give them to make a military effort successful for them?
Yeah, well, no, and again, if there's a determined Russian army effort to beat the Ukrainian army, the Ukrainians will not win. And, mm-hmm. and the Ukrainians understand that. They learned that in August. In August, they were actually on the verge of defeating the separatists. They had compressed the separatists to about one-third the amount of territory that the separatists had held in May and early June. And then on or about August 23rd, the Russian army invaded eastern Ukraine with tanks, artillery, and just hammered the Ukrainians. We heard that anywhere from 50 to 70% of Ukrainian armor in eastern Ukraine was destroyed in about 2 weeks.
Ooh.
So the Ukrainians understand that. But, you know, what we also found when talking to people is there is really a sense of Ukrainian national identity, and there is a will to fight in Ukraine now. It's not a question of the Americans or somebody else providing weapons. Ukraine will fight, because they see themselves as having been invaded. And it was interesting that when we were in Kyiv, we took the train to Dnipropetrovsk, which is in eastern Ukraine, and then had about a three-hour drive to Kramatorsk, which is in the Donetsk province. It's about 45, 50 kilometers from the line of contact at the time. When we drove in that area, and most people would say that's eastern Ukraine, that's sort of the area that people would consider pro-Russian, you saw all of the manifestations of Ukrainian national identity, flags, people having painted fences and roadside signs blue and yellow. And so I think if they can't work out a peace arrangement, if the Russians continue to prosecute this war, the Ukrainians are going to continue to fight.
And tell me about the sanctions. We read that the Soviet Union is just having a really difficult time economically, partially because of oil, but other economic sanctions put on them because of what they're doing in Ukraine. Is that going to be, how effective have the sanctions been, and how much is Russia hurting?
Yeah, well, the United States and the European Union over the last 11 months have applied a series of increasingly robust sanctions, now specifically targeting the Russian energy, finance, and defense sectors. And by all accounts, those sanctions are having a pretty significant impact. So, for example, the Russian Central Bank said that capital flight out of Russia in 2014 amounted to $150 billion. Their total of reserves and sovereign wealth funds has gone from about $500 billion down to perhaps 380. So they went through $120 billion in about 10 months, much of which went to trying to defend the ruble, and the ruble still has lost more than half of its value against the dollar. And the Russian Minister of Economy a few weeks ago said that the Russian economy will be in contraction this year, perhaps by as much as 5%. I think the World Bank estimate is 3%. So there's no doubt that the sanctions, in combination with something that people may not have anticipated a year ago, which is the significant drop in the price of oil, which is usually important to the Russian economy because of all the oil that they export, has had very severe economic impacts. But the sanctions have not yet changed or have not yet achieved their political goal, which is to get the Kremlin to stop the fighting and engage in a serious effort to negotiate a diplomatic settlement.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and we'll take them in just a few moments here. Our guest this hour is Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer. He is the former ambassador to Ukraine. He was with the State Department for 25 years, focusing on U.S. relations with the former Soviet Union and Europe, as well as arms control and security issues. He was U.S. ambassador to Ukraine from 98 to the year 2000. He's director now of the Brookings Arms Control and Non-Proliferation Initiative, and we're welcoming phone calls for him as peace talks are underway with Germany and Russia and Ukraine and France looking at a way to end the bloodshed, and the United States, the president, sending phone calls to Vladimir Putin saying to him as late as yesterday, if Russia continues its aggressive actions in Ukraine, including by sending troop weapons and financing to support the separatists, the cost for Russia will rise. What's the way out of this? What's the way to a lasting ceasefire? How much should we be involved? Our phone number, once again, join us if you would like, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. You can leave comments there as well. And we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now for Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, and we'll start our calls with Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. Just quick question. Ambassador Pfeiffer, you wrote, I think it was on Politico last summer, that NATO has no, quote, NATO has no appetite to take the relationship with Ukraine to a deeper level. I'm wondering what has changed, if anything. Where is NATO now, given recent developments? And I'll listen off the air. Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff.
Sure. No, I think actually if you go back to the last 5 or 6 years now, NATO really has not had any appetite to put Ukraine on a membership track. And certainly the Obama administration has not talked about it. My guess is that, in fact, some people in the Obama administration were happy in 2010 when Viktor Yanukovych became president and said, I don't want to develop the Ukrainian relationship with NATO any further. And I think that was because at the time, the Obama administration was still very much pursuing the reset in relations with Russia. And had Ukraine wanted to continue to try to draw closer to NATO, that would have been a problem. So there's an issue here, though, when you look at how Vladimir Putin talks about it. I mean, one of his justifications for this conflict is he says, well, Ukraine was on the verge of joining NATO. And that's simply and demonstrably not true. Moreover, if you go back to June of last year, President Poroshenko was basically saying publicly, if it'll help resolve this conflict with Russia, I'll take NATO off the table. I don't think President Poroshenko was prepared to say never, ever, but I think he was prepared to say for X years, with X being a long time, Ukraine won't think about moving closer to NATO. The Russians never picked up on that. And the one thing that has changed in the last 8 or 9 months in the NATO-Ukraine relationship is that for the first time ever, polls are now showing a majority of Ukrainians favoring joining NATO. It usually be only 20%. And I would argue that's a result, though, of what they perceive to be an invasion by Russia.
What about this, and this is in your recommendations to people who are making decisions here. You write that President Putin does seem to care about his public standing. Why would he continue to deny that Russia is fighting in Ukraine while his army buries its dead at night and warns wounded vets that they will lose their disability benefits if they disclose they were injured in Ukraine?
No, President Putin continues to this day, as did his foreign minister at the Munich Security Conference on Saturday, deny there's any presence of Russian troops in eastern Ukraine. Now, even if one says you don't want to believe the Ukrainian military or you don't want to believe NATO, go on social media. There are a lot of people in eastern Ukraine in the areas where the Seps are, and they take pictures. It's interesting. And when tanks roll by and they take and they post these pictures, you can then take that picture. You can geospatially locate and say, yes, indeed, that is a tank on the street of downtown Donetsk. And then when you look at the tank, it is a type of a T-72 that is only in the Russian inventory. Back in May of last year, when you would see a tank, you know, the line was, well, the separatists captured that from the Ukrainian army. You know, you're now seeing tanks, you're seeing Tiger fighting vehicles, you're seeing air defense systems in eastern Ukraine that never were in the Ukrainian inventory. They were only in the Russian inventory. And it's the same way with the case of the Buk, the surface-to-air missile system that most people believe shot down Malaysian Air Flight 17 last July, that it came from the Russian inventory.
Jeff, thank you very much for your call. We go to Bill in Platteville next. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Ambassador. I was just wondering, I've read reports in other than U.S. media about an intercepted phone call from an undersecretary of Victoria Nuland, yeah, stating that we spent $4 billion destabilizing the old government in Ukraine and that we were going to install whoever we chose to, and apparently the Europeans wanted somebody else. I mean, how much did we have to do with destabilizing the former government, and how much does the missiles in former Soviet states around Russia have to do with their stance on Ukraine here? I mean, being surrounded by missiles didn't go down very, I mean, Cuba, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis. We didn't like it at our borders. What makes people think Russia should accept it at their borders?
Yeah, no, those are good questions. The first, I mean, there was an intercepted conversation that was posted or made public back in February, I think, of last year between Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, and our ambassador in Kyiv, where they were talking about who in the opposition might be part of the government. I've listened to that conversation. I think it was an analytical conversation. It was the assistant secretary talking with her ambassador on the scene saying, if the opposition comes together, who makes the most sense? I don't buy the idea, and it was the Russians tried to say, this is the Americans setting up the next government, because I know the opposition players, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, Vitaly Klitschko. We didn't have that kind of influence. We did not have that kind of diktat. The $4 billion is actually, and again, it's a number that's been seized upon the rest. I think what Ms. Nuland said was $5 billion, but that is actually the sum total of all U.S. assistance that has gone to Ukraine since 1991. So some of that was for democracy promotion, but a lot of that, for almost $1 billion of that, for example, went to Ukraine to eliminate the strategic bombers and the strategic missiles and the missile silos, the nuclear infrastructure that was left over after the Cold War, which was, I think, a very good and a very smart defense investment that the United States made. Again, in terms of things that we did, I don't think this was at all a U.S. plot. When I talk to people in the U.S. government. I mean, they were following very closely what was going on in Ukraine. But this thing was really much, very much driven by Ukraine and Ukrainians. The last point around about missiles around Russia, the only thing that that could be referring to is there is a plan to put into Poland and Romania, beginning this year and then in 3 years' time in Poland, a small number of anti-missile interceptors. Now, these are, first of all, these are not surface-to-surface missiles. They're designed to defend against incoming ballistic missiles. Moreover, these missiles are of a capability that they can't intercept Russian strategic missiles. They can't go fast enough. And the kinds of missiles that they could intercept, referred to as medium range or intermediate range, Russia is prohibited, as is the United States, by the 1987 Treaty on Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, from having those missiles. NATO took a lot of effort, I think, going back really to 1997, when the enlargement process began, saying things like no intention, plan, or requirement to put nuclear weapons on the territory of new states. And NATO said it would not put, there would be no permanent stationing of substantial combat forces on the territory of new members. NATO tried to hold any military infrastructure back. And quite frankly, if you look at the history of the last 20 years, you're really only seeing some NATO deployments now in the Balkans and in Poland on more of a persistent basis, only taking place really in the last 10, 11 months, that is, after Russia seized Crimea.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655 if you'd like to join our conversation. Give us a better, it's my understanding that President Poroshenko is going to be meeting for the first time face-to-face with Vladimir Putin. We know more about Putin. Give me more of a sense of Poroshenko, who he is, what his background is, if he's an upstanding guy.
Well, Poroshenko is a businessman. I think he would fit into the category of oligarchs in Ukraine, although when you look at his background, he seems to, a lot of oligarchs in Ukraine took advantage of the system. He seems to have done it a bit more the old-fashioned way, just in terms of making smart business decisions and such. He actually has a significant, one of his main businesses is candy, much of which is produced in Russia, so he has a businessman's connection with Russia. And there was, originally when he ran back for president back in the spring of last year, within a couple of months after President Yanukovych left the country, the Ukrainians organized a presidential election. Most people thought that Poroshenko had the skills to probably succeed and deal successfully with Putin. They have had some face-to-face meetings, and they've had, in this particular format that's meeting now with Merkel and Hollande, but you know, it has not produced an agreement. My own guess is that Poroshenko very much wants to have an agreement. I think he would like to settle the crisis in eastern Ukraine or at least stop the fighting so he can focus on a looming financial catastrophe, on much-needed economic reforms. And it may be, though, that he has a political issue in Kyiv, which is that attitudes over the last few months have hardened in face of the Russian attacks in eastern Ukraine, to the point where it may be hard for Poroshenko to go as far as he might like because of strong anti-Russian attitudes, not only within his own cabinet, but also in the parliament and among the general public.
Hmm. So he makes candy.
He's sometimes referred to as the candy king. That's not his only business. But that was sort of the core of his business for much of the 90s.
What kind, forgive me, but what kind of candy? I didn't know.
Chocolates.
Yeah,
right. The chocolate king.
Oh. Our phone number, we have a couple lines open if you want to join our conversation. It's 800-486-8655. And our guest this hour is Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer. He is director of the Brookings Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative. He was ambassador to Ukraine from 1998 to 2000. We're talking about the fighting, the increased number of deaths, the international pressure, the peace talks that are going on right now among leaders of Germany and France and Ukraine and Russia. So feel free to join our conversation. Here's an email that has come in. Ambassador Steve in Adams County says, isn't it likely that Putin is at least partly motivated by a desire to have at least a semblance of a land corridor to his warm water port in Crimea? That's a centuries-old Russian goal.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, this is a problem the Russians have when the Russians occupied Crimea is there is no direct connection from Russia to Crimea. The peninsula actually joins to what is now mainland Ukraine. So the connection right now is a ferry that runs across the Kerch Strait, which connects the Russian mainland with the easternmost point of Crimea. And the problem is, particularly now when the weather is bad, it's really hard to get a lot of stuff across that ferry. So there has been suggestions that the Russian military might launch an attack out of the occupied area of the Donetsk province in eastern Ukraine, drive to where the peninsula connects to mainland Ukraine, and then establish a land bridge. I don't totally rule that out, but I personally think it's not likely because that's about 300 to 350 kilometers. You're talking about a good 200 miles. And it's a lot of area where the population is not really sympathetic to the Russians. There's no doubt if the Russians wanted to make that military drive, they could get there, but that their challenge would then be having to garrison the place to hold it against what would, I think, almost certainly be a partisan war. So it's not totally excluded, but certainly when I was in Ukraine a month ago, of the scenarios that they worried about, that was one that they tended to worry a little bit less about.
Kurt in Eau Claire is next. Hi, Kurt.
Yeah, thank you. We know that there is some fabulously rich oligarchs, corrupt as they may be in Ukraine. And if they desire to do so, to resist Russian, whatever Russia is doing, why should American taxpayers be paying for the arms when they could easily afford to buy them themselves with their money stashed all over the world?
Yeah, no, a couple of points. One is the Ukrainian government budget at this point is in very, very difficult straits. I think some military assistance would be very valuable and needed. There are oligarchs. Unfortunately, some of them actually have gone out and done it, but what they've done is they've funded volunteer battalions. And this is actually something that my co-authors in our report, when we recommended greater military assistance to Ukraine, we also said as a condition of this, you need to tell the Ukrainian government that they need to bring these volunteer battalions under military control. They have to be integrated into the National Guard because it's not a smart way to conduct military operations when outside the Army and the National Guard you have 30 or 35 independent battalions running around on their own. And it's also not a good thing, I would argue, for Ukrainian democracy to have these groups of anywhere from 300 to 800 people with guns running around who are really private armies. Some of the oligarchs have gotten involved, but in not a particularly good way. Now, I think there is in the longer term, as they think through how they're going to come up with a viable financing for the government, one of the things that they should be looking at is, you know, what kind of tax system that would be put in place that, in fact, would draw greater tax revenues from those in Ukraine who are much better off and could afford to pay more.
So are they paying these volunteers a lot of money, and where are they getting these people?
This is some of the problem. I mean, in some cases, I think you have groups that are genuinely, they're patriots, they've come together. In some cases, you have, again, oligarchs are funding basically private armies. I don't know exactly how much they're paying, but in the economic circumstances in Ukraine now, it's probably not that much. But some of these groups are very troubling. I mean, one group, one battalion, which has fought fairly effectively, also displays neo-fascist symbols. And it's something that is not healthy for Ukrainian democracy. It's also very unhelpful because it plays right into Russia propaganda when Russia tries to portray what I would argue was a basically civil disobedience last year in Ukraine that brought the President Yanukovych to the point where he end up fleeing the capital. You know, it gives a kernel to what the Russians say about, well, this is really a neo-fascist coup.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Kurt, very much for your call. Scott and Toma, hi. Scott, hi.
Yes, I'm calling to ask Hello?
Yeah, we're here, Scott. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm calling to ask if it intimidates Ukraine that, or if it looks bad, that Russia and North Korea are going to be doing missions together, and that we have stated that we might possibly send arms to Ukraine, but we have had this small little conflict with North Korea.
I don't understand. What's your, you have a question here, Scott? He's gone. Can you glean anything from that?
No, I mean, if it was a question about Russia sending arms to Ukraine, that's already happening. I mean, they've sent tanks in, they've sent artillery, surface-to-surface rockets, surface-to-air missile systems. That threshold has already been crossed, and it was crossed probably last May, April.
In North Korea?
There has been talk. I think the Russians said last week, the Russian military said that they might start some kind of military-to-military cooperation with North Korea, but I would be astonished if it had any impact on what's going on in Ukraine.
We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about the 10 months of conflict in Ukraine. It has claimed, our guest believes, more than 5,400 lives. And now we have peace talks taking place, beginning today with the leaders of Russia, Ukraine, France, and Germany. The president of Ukraine warning that this conflict could spiral out of control if there is no ceasefire and no de-escalation. And the question of the hour is how to get Russia to agree to that. What should the involvement of the United States be in this as well as any historical questions that you may have? Our guest is certainly versed on all of these areas and was recently in Ukraine. Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer is our guest. He's director of the Brookings Arms Control and Non-Proliferation Initiative. He was ambassador to Ukraine from 1998 to 2000 and has served with the State Department as a foreign service officer for more than 25 years, focusing on U.S. relations with the former Soviet Union and Europe, as well as arms control and security issues. To you, more of your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls for Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, and James in Milwaukee is next. Hi, James.
Yeah, hello. I have actually a lot of concerns with this issue, but I'm going to try and maybe stress one of the more important ones. I have family members who are Russian, and I know several people from Ukraine. And I just wanted to sort of make the point that we have this perception in the U.S. that foreign intervention, mainly on the part of Russia, is to blame here. And certainly, you know, I would not deny that there's obvious foreign intervention going on there. But there seems to me that there's also intervention in Ukraine on the part of the West. And I actually spoke to a Ukrainian friend of mine recently who about this whole situation, who told me a joke. I mean, it's hard to joke about a tragic situation like this, but there's seemed to be some truth in it, and it seems to convey a perception that's common in Ukraine. And the joke goes, Russia and America are at war, and then pause, down to the last Ukrainian. So I guess what I would like to ask is for comments on the various types of intervention that are at play here in this conflict.
Okay, well, at this point, I think it's clear the Russians have intervened in a very major way. First, there's no disputing that they used their military to seize Crimea, and I think there's very clear evidence that the Russians have heavily involved themselves in eastern Ukraine. As of the end of last year, the Obama administration had said it would supply about $120 million of military assistance, all non-lethal, things like body armor, night vision goggles, tents, and such. So I think the scale is just hugely different. And if the Ukrainians get more assistance from the West, or if they do not, My belief is that they are going to continue to fight as long as the Russians and the separatists continue this. So I don't think it's a matter of American military assistance if it gets increased, as some of us have advocated, prolonging a conflict that would not continue in any event. There are a large number of Ukrainians who feel that the Russians have invaded their territory, and they're going to continue to resist. The argument that we made in our report was that providing certain types of equipment to the Ukrainian military would allow them to defend themselves in a better way and hopefully begin to move the Russians away from the military option and get the Russians to shift to a negotiated diplomatic settlement.
I've been thinking during our pauses in the show about what you said about the polls showing that now a majority of Ukrainians would be interested in being part of NATO. But you also said that it used to be that 20% believe that. Why wouldn't people want to be a part of NATO in the Ukraine, and what do they hope NATO will do for them now?
Well, I think that the big factor that's changed this is that they believe that if they're in a member of NATO, they're not going to have this fight with Russia. But by the same token, I think that's one of the things that will make it harder. My guess is that there are a lot of European members of NATO who now would argue we can't consider Ukraine precisely because we don't want to get into that fight with Russia.
Mm-hmm. James, thanks for your call. Debbie in Madison. Hi.
Hello?
Hi, Debbie. Go ahead.
Hi. I believe I heard on the radio last night that Putin was in Egypt and was received with fanfare and promised help to Egypt in building a nuclear reactor. And if that's true, does your guest see any connection with Ukraine? Is this some sort of veiled threat? The timing of it, I find really curious. And that's all. That's
okay,
my question.
Okay, thanks, Debbie.
Well, I think, the Kremlin, I think, is feeling uncomfortable now because they are under a certain amount of political isolation. So, for example, already last spring, the G8 became a G7 when the United States, Canada, Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and Japan disinvited Russia. And so you have seen a more active outreach by the Russians to build up and shore up other linkages to sort of say, well, look, we're not isolated, when I think, in fact, they are quite isolated, at least from the West. In the case of a nuclear reactor, I mean, the Russians also, though, in general, have tried nuclear reactors is one of the few things they make that the rest of the world actually buys. So they have, in general, tried to promote nuclear energy and the sale of nuclear reactors. As long as that was done in a way consistent with Egypt's, with not allowing Egypt to get nuclear weapons, and that there were two safeguards on the technology, that should not be a problem. And my guess is, you know, the actual connection to the Ukraine case is probably relatively thin.
Zach sends this email, Ambassador. Many Americans worry that Russia's actions in Ukraine are at least partially motivated by a desire to provoke military intervention, however minor, by the West. Is there any evidence to substantiate this concern?
I'm not sure on that one. I mean, certainly since in the last week or two, when there's been more public discussion in Washington about the providing weapons to Ukraine, what you're seeing coming out of Moscow is lots of don't do it, don't do it. So I don't think this would be a welcome development in Russia. Although some people do say that, you know, Putin may have some kind of an interest in keeping this sort of conflict going as a way to distract the population from the fact that, you know, their economic situations are likely to become more difficult. There are some predictions that say that as a result of the economic sanctions and the fall in the price of oil, the average Russian may, over the course of the next 6 to 12 months, see his or her purchasing power decline by 10 to 20%.
That's a lot.
And so some say, well, maybe he's trying to stir this conflict up to get a feeling of patriotism towards this conflict and to distract people from the fact that their economic situation is deteriorating.
Mm-hmm. And Jim in Madison sends this email. Why would the American authorities be involved in a former Soviet nation almost 5,000 miles away? Ukraine's democratically elected government was overthrown with aid mostly from the State Department.
Well, first of all, I disagree with the premise of the question. I think Viktor Yanukovych left Ukraine because he made a series of bad decisions, beginning with his refusal to sign an association agreement, which his government had negotiated, and then with use of force, and you had 200,000, 300,000 people on the streets of Kyiv demanding that he depart. That's not something the U.S. government can orchestrate, and I think that's simply a myth. Why should the United States care? Again, I would go back to the 1994 Budapest Memorandum, and again, since I negotiated, perhaps I'm a little bit too close to the document. But in 1994, the biggest American objective with regards to the collapse of the Soviet Union was to ensure that it did not produce an increase in the number of nuclear weapon states. And at the time, you know, the focus was on Ukraine because of the 1900 strategic nuclear warheads, again, all targetable at the United States. And part of the agreement, and some Ukrainians will say the most important thing for them was that agreement on security assurances. The Russians now have violated those. You know, if the United States does not respond adequately, it doesn't speak well of our sense of obligation when we make a commitment. But it also, I would argue, may have a wider non-proliferation impact, is to the extent that these kinds of security assurances might play a role in persuading other countries either to give up or not to acquire nuclear weapons. If our security assurances in the Budapest Memorandum are devalued, that's a tool we don't have in other non-proliferation efforts.
And what about increased sanctions? Have we already done as much as we can in that area, or would more be effective, and what would they be?
I think more sanctions are possible, and if there is not a success in Minsk and the Russians continue to support the insurgency in eastern Ukraine, are perhaps even likely. I think what you would do is you would see an expansion of the number of companies that are on the sanctions list. So, for example, the U.S. government now sanctions Gazprom's bank. Gazprom is the largest company in Russia. It exports large amounts of gas. The bank is under sanction, but not Gazprom per se. But you could see an expansion and more companies come under that list. The effect of these sanctions is it makes it virtually impossible for these companies to get financing in the West. And I'll give you just one example of how painful that can be. The estimate is that Russian corporations in 2015 have about $110 billion in corporate debt to Western banks that come due this year. Typically, a company would go to a bank and just refinance it or roll it over. The problem that they have now is those companies cannot refinance that debt in the West, and they're going to have to find that somewhere else, and that may well fall on the Russian government's budget then.
And how long are these current round of peace negotiations going to last? Do we know? Is it like for a week or the next couple days?
Well, the hope is there were quite a bit of effort to prepare the way. So there have been preliminary discussions. I think the hope was to try to get it done even sometime today.
Oh.
But we don't know. My guess is, at the best, there will be an agreement on a ceasefire and then perhaps the outlines of what a peace settlement might look like. There then is going to have to be a lot of attention to implementation, and that's going to be key. It would be a total disaster if this meeting in Minsk produces a settlement and then it falls apart because the sides don't implement it in the same way that happened last September. If that happens, we'll find ourselves back 5 or 6 months from now in the same awful situation, but perhaps the fighting having spread and more dead people in Ukraine.
Yeah. Ambassador Pfeiffer, thank you very much for being with us. A very informative hour.
Thank you for having me.
Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, our guest. He was ambassador to Ukraine from 1998 to 2000. He's director of the Brookings Arms Control and Non-Proliferation Initiative and has a lot more involvement as well. He was with the State Department for some 25 years, focusing on the Soviet Union, and Europe, arms control and security issues. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this interesting show, and to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Stay with us. Co-housing, interesting movement. We'll talk about it and how it's doing very well in Europe, and it's just starting to begin to happen in the United States. So that's our conversation, hour two of our program for this Wednesday afternoon.